Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thanks for coming. It means a lot. I really appreciate this time that we have here together. So, I'm still kind of sick. It's been a long one. So, still thinking about how physical discomforts can impede whatever our intentions are. When we are feeling under the weather, we can often have other psychosomatic symptoms that go with the physical, you know? You can get sad or depressed when you're sick. You can get stressed and even more stressed. You know, one of my friends who I work with has been under the weather too and has basically almost been hospitalized because of COVID. And he's very sad right now, being home alone, you know, not having any of those creature comforts or at least markers that tell us that we are, you know, doing something. But we don't always have to have markers to tell us that we're doing something. At any moment in time, just as we are perfect. And not perfect in the sense of a judgment call of what perfection is. But stay with me here. At any moment in time, whatever you're doing, whatever you've chosen to do, is the only thing you could have done because you can't go back in the past. Before you've made a decision, you have this tree network of choices available to you, but only one decision can ever be made. You know, so it's best to just accept it and own it. And if we hurt somebody, we rectify it. We apologize, we make it better, or do something. And sometimes we can't make it better. And maybe that's just part of our causal play at that moment in time. But I'm determined to be the best person that I can be and to honestly live my life. And so I try to accept what I do at face value. And I try not to mire myself in judgment, shame, and guilt. When we shame ourselves because of past actions, that doesn't help us produce better actions. Shame itself could be a reinforcing power that can create a self-fulfilling prophecy or a feedback loop of some sort that reinforces itself to continue making that situation happen. Shame and guilt are excellent precursors of events like that. But outside of shame and guilt, how do we pick ourselves up and love ourselves? And through loving ourself, where ourself is a reflection of our world, and our world is a reflection of ourself, continuously going back and forth, like ping pong. By loving ourself and by giving ourself compassion, we can produce that positive flow towards others and towards our world in that same exact sort of reinforcement loop. We can reinforce love. And what is love? I see love as an immortal force that we are all born with. Everyone is born in and with love. I see love as the background substrate that holds material matter together. All atoms have so much empty space in them. An electron is point, the electrons in their field is 0.0001% of the actual weight and mass of the physical atom. And within the neutrons, what makes up neutrons is these quarks, and when they zoom in, I have this suspicion that's probably been reinforced by some sort of empirical science that you would find much more empty space even within the protons and within the little pieces of electrons if you try to make up those particles. There's so much empty space within everything that's holding everything together. But there's this tug, this magnetism between things that holds things together. And that magnetic force, I think within that space and between the material outside of it, but also holding it like a ball floating in the ocean. That's love for me. And tapping into this primal force of my basic humanity, when I feel it, it's like a megawatt light bulb, you know? When I look inside my subconscious, past the things that I know that I don't know, into the murky worlds of all the rest of what I am, it seems infinite. And I think that there's an infinite space within you as well. And I think it's filled with love. And I think we adorn ourselves as humans with all these personalities like clothing. We put upon ourselves charisma and we decide all the expressions that we want to play for people, like an actor on a stage. And we adorn ourselves with, this is how I do this. This is how I do this. This is how you will see me do this. And an audience, the members of a group who are endowed with the witnessing of whatever show you're putting on, have this natural, like, tendency to accept at credence what you have to say in your expression. So it might be much more visible to yourself that the air or the show that you're putting on is distant or away from your base and primal humanity. And that's when these parts come up, these actors of who we are, these parts that play the different pieces for us. It's like we are these multifaceted organisms and creatures. And every single time that we encounter a new situation, a new person, or a new ignorance, we have a different face to show it in that moment. But behind all of the faces and behind all the parts, I truly, truly believe is this basis of love. And in some books, that might be called a soul. I like to call it a spark when I was younger, the spark of life. But there's an essence in being a member of life that makes us, in almost a way, divine, or at least attached to the divine. And I'm not a big God person, in a long shot. And for a long time, I even hesitated using the word God because I didn't know how. And in all honesty, I had no actual definition for the term besides this idol of idea. And so what is an idol? An idol could be the golden calf from the Bible stories within the Christian context. But the idea of an old white dude sitting on a throne, making decisions and judging people, which is never discreetly mentioned in the Bible, is an idea of what God is. And that idea was idolized in my head and my upbringing when I was found in myself around this organized religion that I could not swallow. And so that idol was very sticky in its place in my head for a long time, until I started trying to build my own basic spiritual system. And so let's step outside of Christianity for a little bit. In Hinduism, Brahman, the big self, the big soul, is like a giant mechanism or organism that is the universe, that has a breath cycle where every one of its in-breaths is 4.6 billion years and every one of its out-breaths is 4.6 billion years. So it's on such a vast cosmic scale. And it's like a multiverse within this organism. So even our universe and our world is just one little small facet of this massive, gigantic organism. Yet in Hinduism, the little Atman, the little self, the little soul that we all imbibe, that we all have in our center, is complete and a piece of that God, a piece of that power. So I don't know. I'm going to put out this quote. I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to make it personal just because this is why I was in my head. I put out this quote yesterday on Facebook because I'm reading this book by this yogi. He was definitely kind of culty, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of negative material because he came to the United States, and he set up a lot of ashram self-realization places around Southern California back in the 1930s, which I found was very, very early because this is like almost 30, 40 years before the hippie movement. So this is like bedrock for this East-West mishmash where United States civilization took a huge turn. And I found this metaphor from this guy, Paramahansa Yogananda. Sorry, I'm going to say that again. Paramahansa Yogananda. So here's his quote. It was just a book of quotes that I picked up. Milk poured into water mixes with it. But butter churned from milk floats on top of the water. The master said, similarly, the milk of an ordinary person's mind is quickly diluted by the waters of delusion. The man of spiritual self-discipline churns the milk of his mind into the butter state of divine stability. Free from earthly desires and attachment, he is able to float serenely on the waters of worldly life, ever intent on God. Okay. In this whole sentence, there's God, and the word divine, and the word spiritual. If you were to take all those words out, this quotation has very little to say about any religion, really. Like, if I didn't tag on the name Paramahansa Yogananda, it'd be very hard to tell, and my gut instinctual reaction would not have been to think that it was Christianity that I was speaking about. But I had a friend of mine reply, which in a way I can understand where he's coming from, but just you could tell that this person only saw those three words and had a negative reflex against them that they felt had to be spoken. So here goes. This life on earth has never been about God, Jesus, the devil, priests, etc. Those are all distractions away from the esoteric knowledge of truth. It's always been about us, always, mastering ourselves, ascension, and manifestation. The waters have been polluted with exoteric stories. To my reply, in Hinduism, the world, and our parts to play, are to God what a cell is to my body. Attempt to picture a verb with no noun. What would that look like? I am not a Hindu, but I also did not mention priests or Jesus, whom have as little to do with Hinduism as I do. I simply find it intriguing. In my own spiritual system that I am building for myself, the personality and desire is the base delusion. Even when we are perfectly alone, we can be affected by these illusions. So I guess we're both in our own little echo chambers here, and I hope that he can hear me. I can hear where he's going from, you know? Like, I get how, as individuals, because it'd be boring if any of us were anything like anybody else. But even though we all have the same biology, and even though we all have similar states of mind that we can go into, even, you know, every single person has a different reflexive reaction to the world. And this is individuality, you know? And we need that in order to have the healthy amount of self-pride that is necessary for inner growth and for self-actualization in any way, shape, or form. We have to have that little bit of petty desire for ourselves. But I do think it's also possible to manifest and to ascend the personality and the idolized me. I think it's possible to live for others and to live for the world. And that sometimes that can be stronger structurally because we're basing our lives on reality instead of basing reality on our lives. which I feel can be very dangerous in some ways. So, consider what it means to be part of the world. And let's drop the God talk, and let's get away from those buzzwords that make people instinctually clench. Let's think about our relationship with the world. And what is a relationship? A relationship is a relation between two beings, I would assume. I think some people have relationships with inanimate objects, for sure. It can have drastic consequences if you take the cell phone away from Lucy. But when we relate to others, we have to have a mental model of the world and the other in our head. And this model may or may not be accurate. 99.9% of the time it isn't. But we are using this model in order to relate. And depending on how well you can build your model, you can relate better. So we're picturing, based upon these expressions that others are giving us, they're spilling us this yarn, they're speaking their speak, they're telling their story of who they think they are to us, and we listen, and we start building a model of who they are in our head based upon the information they've given us and our judgments of them. This quasi false ability to actually look at somebody, because you know who knows who they are? That person. That other knows exactly how they feel and what they're trying to express. Sometimes they may be unaware of their intentions and their motivations, but they're still aware of their actions and they're aware of how they feel about it. And they're aware when they express something, if it's not taken right, so they're going to be insulted or they're going to feel unheard. But we have a model that we build in our heads of other people and the world, you know. I have, you know, that game, Skee-Ball. And I'm aiming for the top left hole that's 100 points. It's a pain in the dick to get because it's not right in the middle. And you got to kind of put a spin on it. I have to see where that hole is in my head before I tell my muscles where to throw it. And a lot of the times I don't make the hole because that model doesn't actually fit right. And I'm not smart enough. I'm not vain enough to think that I can build the world in my head that well. But I can try. Now, we might have a difficult relationship with another person, you know? And within relationship becomes relatability. And so, in order to fully relate to somebody of very different origins than you, and this has nothing to do with skin color, but it could just be a geographic origin within even one city, depending on what side of the train tracks you're born on, is going to institute into you a certain group image of yourself that's been fed to you by everybody around you too. Now, if I'm speaking with somebody from the other side of the tracks, this isn't to put me in a wealth or a poverty position. I'm just speaking to the other very generally here. When I do that, I have to drop myself for a period of time. I have to ascend past my own personality, my own cloth that I've put upon myself of personality, and I have to drop that, and I have to gear all of my sensory uptake equipment, all of my sensitive emotional hardware, I have to gear towards this other so that I can try to imprint upon myself as clearly as possible what they are feeling. And the whole time, I know that I can't do it perfectly. So, rather than judge the person based upon my own opinions, it'd be very unwise to make those calls since I'm using equipment that has faults, this human vessel. But with enough sensitivity, I can show immense compassion towards somebody that I do not understand, that I have not been in their shoes, but I can still show them compassion. This is sympathy. Empathy is where you know where they've been. Empathy is where you can feel their feelings. Sympathy is when you just hold their feelings and accept who they are and allow them to be. And you can give them concern. You can say, ow, that hurts. Ow, that's a hard spot to be in. That's a difficult situation. You know, I'm sorry. I wouldn't want to do that either. You know? But consider that there is a spectrum of being out there. And consider that perhaps the other that you're speaking with has been trampled upon, has been burdened, and has been hurt by others, has had judgments thrown at them based upon their community upbringing, based upon their conceived self. And yet again, all these things are just personality. All these things are just clothing that that other person has put upon themselves. But some of that clothing can be very heavy. Inside, they carry the same love that you and I do. They carry the same spirit, in my opinion. But they've adorned themselves with drastically different clothing. And maybe they have earmuffs on. And maybe their sensible equipment, their sensitivity, isn't attuned to you. And maybe they've been hurt so many times that all they can do is reflexively clench back and protect their clothing. And even in an attempt at compassion, which even compassion can be an exertion of control. If I want to help you so badly that I'm willing to change you, and you're miserable, sure, but I'm still willing to change you and force you into something because of my will, that's control, even if it's a compassionate goal, you know? So maybe some people in their lot in life and where they happen to be, and this doesn't mean forever, they may become more sensitive in the future, but for the moment, they might not have the capacity to be able to hear you and be able to hear and to drop and ascend past their own self and drop their self for a little bit. Maybe they can't hear past their own white noise to hear how you feel. And there's no way to judge that because in this current moment, that's what they're doing. And you just have to let them be. And you just have to love them. And through that, that love inspires and is infectious and grows within them. I was fighting with this guy for a couple weeks at work. And, you know, like we didn't talk to each other for 2 weeks. And he threatened me, and he threatened my family. He threatened to hurt me. He said a lot of awful things to me. And after 2 weeks of being in this state of tension and feeling nauseous in the environment, I decided I was over it. And my base humanity is love. And even this person who's hurt me is not my enemy. And I can still love him. I can still show compassion. And I'm always doing all these little things in my life for all the people around me. I do lots of little actions and little deeds and little examples of how I feel about you and how I feel about others in my life that are very important to me. And for 2 weeks, I've been only ignoring this man because I had gotten up in my head and I had adorned armor. I put armor over myself to defend myself. And so I hadn't talked to him, I hadn't helped him, and I just let him be. And that didn't help him in the way. I didn't just let him be, you know, because I was judging him. He was bad, and so that's why I was refusing my contact with him, which is just another form of control. It wasn't letting me let him go, you know? Like, it was still me actively doing something inside. And I realized this, and I realized that I had been personifying and living in my armor, and I hadn't been in contact with who I was for a while. So I decided to fuck that. And right then and there, I just started showing him little compassions. I started helping him with his dishes. I started talking to him, you know, instead of ignoring him. When I passed by, I'd say right behind, you know, nothing that wasn't full of respect and nothing that was like what homies or friends would say to each other. But I started noticing him and showing him vividly that I was noticing him be. Noticing him there. I wasn't ignoring him anymore. And I swear to God, people, 2, maybe 3 hours later, he was helping me. He was talking to me. He was smiling to me, giving stories to me, making eye contact with me. And that all started with me going backwards to my base humanity, to my loving center, and taking off all the garbs that I put upon and that I try to impress upon people through my expressions. Be very aware of who you are. And not everybody is in the exact same place at the exact same time. But we all have origins that are very similar. Well, that's for the most part my talk for today. I would like to mention something. I recently joined this church. At first I thought it was kind of culty, just because of a lot of the stories I've heard, and I'm always very resistant to organizations. But this is really interesting. So it's called the Church of Silomathoxen, and there's a Facebook group on Facebook, and there's also a website called silomathoxen.com. That's silomethoxen.com. There you can join the church. It's kind of like an internet church. It's based down in the southern United States, but I've noticed that out of the 1,000 members or more at this point, there's members from Poland, and there's people from out of country, Canada. So it's spreading, and it's not based in a physical location, which is what drew me to it, because if I had to go to like some to some compound or to some actual place, I would be very resistant to doing these kind of things. But it's easier to do it on the internet. So what is Silomathoxen? So this is very interesting. So we're going to go backwards just a little bit more. So you have psilocybe cubensis and, you know, psilocybe pinoleus. There's a whole bunch of different strains of mushrooms that produce psilocybin. Psilocybin is a prodrug for psilocin. Psilocin is also called 4-hydroxydimethyltryptamine, 4-HODMT. So before joining this, I didn't realize, because I always knew in my heart that DMT and mushrooms, psilocin, were very similar because they taste the same, but of course drastically different because they're different compounds. But I knew how close they were, and I used to tell people forever that they were like kissing cousins. You know, like they're just that fucking close. But even in the name, when you knock off the methyl group from psilocybin and you knock off the 4-HO, the hydroxylization, that 4-hydroxy group, which is just 4 hydrogens and 1 oxygen, like it looks kind of like a telephone antenna, not a telephone antenna, like a TV radar antenna, like you know, a T. But that hydroxy group on the dimethyltryptamine compound, even though it's a very small adjustment, makes this compound that is relatively volatile. And what do I mean by volatile? So DMT in its natural occurring state does not exist for very long in the body. Like most people, when they imbibe DMT, if it's not in an edible format, like psilocin, is through smoking it. And freebase doesn't like to hang out in the blood for more than like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes max, you know? And that's because the substance has nowhere to go, and there's no biomechanical mechanisms to hold it in place and to let it sit in the brain for a long time. So the hydroxy group changes the chemistry of the DMT molecule enough to make it so that psilocin is very psychoactive, even though it has a different approach, for up to 6 to 8 hours, versus DMT is only like at 10 minutes, right? So here's where the fun comes in. Back in the 1960s, there's this group of scientists somewhere who used this plant, this flower from Mexico called vanilla orthonin, or orthovanillin, sorry, I'm butchering all these sciencey terms. Thank you. I'm a mush mouth, and I really appreciate you guys for your patience. So using orthovanillin, they got this new compound called 4-hydroxy-5-methoxy-DMT. So 5-MeO-DMT, 5-MeO is another tryptamine that has a slightly different orientation and molecular composition, that it's chemically different than DMT, which that 5-methoxy group on the DMT molecule makes it 5-MeO-DMT. So 5-MeO-DMT has a very different approach than dimethyltryptamine, but yet again, in its freebase form, does not like to hang out in the body for very long. Most people who have been ingesting 5-methoxy-DMT, like one of the most prevalent sources that I've heard of is the river toad. So there's toads, these big old fucking amphibians that live all over like Arizona and some parts of Colorado, all the way down to Mexico. And they produce this venom in their like little venom sacs behind their eyes, where if you squeeze it, that venom contains almost pure 5-methoxy-DMT. And you can look up videos of this shit online, and those people, like when they smoke it, like their eyes roll back in their head. Like, it looks very scary. And I've smoked pure 5-methoxy-DMT on a couple occasions just because it was a byproduct of the process to get N,N-DMT, which is freebase DMT. Like, most plants that contain the DMT also contain trace amounts of 5-methoxy. So you're always trying to get the two partners away from each other. And so, like, I've had access to pure stuff before, and it was always very, it was just a very different approach. It's like two family members that are in the same family, but just still different enough. You know, psilocin and DMT are much closer in relation than 5-methoxy-DMT and DMT are, you know? And then you have things like LSD, which are like in another room of the house, because LSD is way different from these base tryptamines that I've been discussing. And then in the house next door, you have like phenethylamines, like PCP, mescaline, and all those other cactuses. And like, those are tryptamines in themselves, but are not tryptamines, they're hallucinogenics in themselves, but they're still, you know, a house next door, because they're very different. So it's like a big world to play around. All right. Anyway, that's context. So somebody produces a hydroxylated, so a 4-HO5-MeO-DMT, which would be the counterpart to, which is basically what psilocin is to DMT. It's a 4-hydroxy-DMT. So nobody does anything about it because it takes like 2.5 to 3 months to do this extraction process to get the 4-hydroxy. And they basically put it in the gutter because they're like, this is way too complicated. It's not a viable solution. Nobody can make it. Even if you're really smart, it's really difficult. And then the Shulgin guy, Alexander Shulgin, was putting weird tryptamines on mushroom substrate. And because these creatures, these organisms, the psilocybe cubensis, are hydroxylating tryptophan and making psilocin. So somehow these organisms are doing the hydroxylation process in vitro, inside their bodies, basically, without extractions or without any sort of fucking chemistry. Well, I guess they are doing chemistry, they're just doing it on a molecular level. So Shulgin takes DEPT and DIPT and puts it into the water in a salt form that the mushrooms can then eat. And lo and behold, they start to hydroxylate the DPT, and they start mixing 4-hydroxy-DPT, 4-hydroxy-DEPT. I know that's a lot of letters. Thank you guys for hanging on with me here. So I'm just so fucking excited. It's really interesting. So Shulgin goes, if you were to take 5-methoxy-DMT and feed it to the mushrooms, hands down, it would be very likely that you'd get an edible form of 5-methoxy-DMT. It would hydroxylate it. So last year, this church down in Florida decided to do that. So they take 5-methoxy salt, they put it into the water, and they feed that water to the substrate that they inoculate the mushroom spores on. And lo and behold, these creatures stop producing psilocybin. They stop hydroxylating the tryptophan. They start hydroxylating the 5-methoxy-DMT. And you have this new novel tryptamine that's pretty much only been available for about a year called psilomethoxin. So psilomethoxin is chemically made through the same process that psilocin is made. And it's very unique, you know. Anyways, that's my diatribe from science today. That was kind of long. But do feel free to look into it. I really would encourage some investigation and just check the shit out. So I think it's kind of cool. It's so rare that novelty approaches me in these stages of my life where I'm getting out of my youth and starting to feel old. And novelty is one of the graces that really just excite me. Well, either way, I'm going to go get a good book and then we'll wrap it up with O. Thank you guys so much for listening to me. I very much appreciate you. And I think you are a beautiful, beautiful human being surrounded by beauty in this life. So thank you for being, and I'm grateful that you woke up this morning and took your breath. So a lot of my discussion on performances, expression, and impression came from my readings of this dude named Irving Goffman. It's a book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And this is just a short excerpt from his writing, just so you can see what it feels like. It's pretty dense and deep, but I've been enjoying it. This is from a subheading, Idealization. It was suggested earlier that a performance of a routine presents through its front some rather abstract claims upon the audience, claims that are likely to be presented to them during the performance of other routines. This constitutes one way in which a performance is socialized, molded, and modified to fit into the understanding and expectations of the society in which it is presented. I want to consider here another important aspect of the socialization process: the tendency for performers to offer their observers an impression that is idealized in several different ways. The notion that a performance presents an idealized view of the situation is, of course, quite common. Cooley's view may be taken as an illustration. If we never tried to seem a little better than we are, how could we improve our train or train ourselves from the outside inward? And the same impulse to show the world a better or idealized aspect of ourselves finds an organized expression in the various professions and classes, each of which has to some extent a cant or pose, which its members assume unconsciously for the most part, but which has the effect of a conspiracy to work upon the credulity of the rest of the world. There is a cant, not only of theology and of philanthropy, but also of law, medicine, teaching, even of science, perhaps especially of science. Just now, since the more a particular kind of merit is recognized and admired, the more it is likely to be assumed by the unworthy. All right. And last for you today, I'm reading from a book called As You Think, which is based upon the old classic As a Man Thinketh by this dude named James Allen, who's writing in the early 1900s. A lot of people call it the first self-help book, although I think it directly says in the beginning it calls it a self-empowerment book. All right, this is from the second chapter, The Effects of Thought on Consciousness. Your mind may be likened to a garden that may be intelligently cultivated or allowed to run wild, but whether cultivated or neglected, it must and will bring forth. If no useful seeds are put into them, then an abundance of useless weed seeds will fall therein and will continue to produce their kind. Just as gardeners cultivate their plots, keeping them free from weeds and growing in flowers and fruits they desire, so you may tend the garden of your mind, weeding out all the wrong, useless, and impure thoughts, and cultivating towards perfection the flowers and fruits of right, useful, and pure thought. By pursuing this process, you will sooner or later discover that you are the master gardener of your soul, the director of your life. You also reveal within yourself the laws of thought and understand with ever-increasing accuracy how the forces of thought and elements of the mind operate in the shaping of your character, circumstance, and your destiny. He's great. Basically, the whole book's like that, but in a couple different flavors. Well, yeah, I'm going to go get home.
No, bye.
No, none of that today. Tell me something interesting.
Just hello, bye.
Just hello, bye?
Yeah.
What is hello, bye?
Bye.
What is hello, bye? Come on, say something interesting. What'd you do yesterday?
Bye.
You bye'd yesterday? How did you buy yesterday? Can you buy today?
Buy.
In all times?
Buy.
Can you buy in the future?
Yeah.
How?
Buy.
How do you buy now?
Buy.
Can you buy later?
No.
Can you buy inside?
No.
Can you buy outside?
Buy people.
Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Now, I'm actually not ready yet. Sorry for a distraction, but I actually was going to say something, but I forgot it.
You forgot? I forget things all the time. Thank you, everybody. We love you. We hope you have a great week. Bye.